History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And really, they don't have to if we'll take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our more experienced neighbors. And more importantly, if we listen to what they have to say, it's certainly going to add to our perspective. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price it's been paid for our freedom. And you know, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The inescapable reality is that every day we lose more of these heroes that put their lives on the line for us so long ago. Of the more than 16 million Americans who served in our armed forces during World War II, it's estimated that fewer than 300,000 remain with us today. All the more reason for you to talk to the veterans in your life now and capture those stories before it's too late. If you happen to pick up a Christmas edition of the New York Times last week, or read it online, of course, you may have noticed this headline. Robert Thacker, 102, dies, survived Pearl Harbor to fly in three wars. The subhead, his unarmed bomber, was caught in the thick of Japan's attack. He went on to fly some 80 missions in World War II and become a record-setting test pilot. That obituary piece by Richard Goldstein features a couple of photos the New York Times took 73 years ago after a record-setting flight Robert Thacker completed. This amazing American passed away November 25th, but that news wasn't released until last week. I know it's hard to think of somebody passing a couple months shy of his 103rd birthday as surprising, but I have to admit that the news of Colonel Thacker's passing came as quite a jolt for me. It may sound cliche, but he was truly one of those people you just never expect to lose. The last time I spoke with him, he had just survived being run over by an SUV while crossing the street near his home in San Clemente, California, and that was 3 years ago. Resilient doesn't begin to describe Robert Thacker. Spirited, yes, but it's more than that, too. But why listen to my description when you can hear it in his own voice? This interview was recorded when he was 95, still walking 5 miles a day around San Clemente, and at that point still competing in model airplane competitions. I had to ask Colonel Thacker what got him hooked on aviation so many years ago in his native El Centro, California.
There was a gentleman by the name of Lindbergh, and he was the first person out of many, many, many that made it from New York to Paris, non-stop in the Spirit of St. Louis. And I'm only about 120 miles from San Diego, where the Spirit of St. Louis was made and constructed by Ryan Aircraft Company. And I was bitten. I said, that's what I'm going to do when I'm a little older. And that was in 1927. And Lindbergh was a true genius.
So just reading about it in the newspaper and hearing about him, you said, that's something that I want to do?
Yes, absolutely. I followed that along as quickly as I could. Went through El Centro High, El Centro Junior College, graduated from El Centro JC in 1937. Actually, all of a sudden, I kind of ran out of money and brains at the same time. So I thought I would enlist in the Air Force, in the Air Corps in those days, and I took my physical in 1937. There were 10 of us at March. There were two of us passed. One of them didn't look like an officer, so they failed him, and I was one out of 10 that started out passing the physical. Can you imagine such idiocy? You didn't look like an officer, so you're failed. But I only had 2 years of college, so I had to wait a couple of years before I was called for my pilot training. And I enlisted as a flying cadet in 1939, and I took off from there.
Do you remember a big thrill the first time you got up in the air? Is that something that's still fresh in your mind after all the flight hours you have since then?
Well, actually not, because I had been in the model business and flying model aircraft, and I knew most of the aerodynamics and most of the background, and I had a couple of flights before that with civilian aircraft. So I was not too much impressed with the situation initially. As you know, I have sort of a problem attitude towards situations. Actually, the big surprise I got when I got to primary was I saw all these airplanes snaking down the taxiway. And I thought, my God, I can taxi straighter than that. What's going on around here? Well, as a student, you're in the back seat and you're blind, so you have to snake along so you won't run into the guy in front of you. So I really wasn't so smart after all.
One of the questions I ask every veteran that I interview, regardless of what branch of service, regardless of what his duties were in the war, I ask them all about December 7th, 1941. I know you have a very interesting story about that, but I want to hear a little bit before that. What were you doing in the build-up to that day, and how were you where you were?
I'll tell you who you are. You're a second lieutenant, and you're stationed at Salt Lake City at Fort Douglas, which they ran the Indians out of. So you can imagine what status was when we were in Salt Lake City. This is, you're married about 8 or 9 months, and nothing yet. About December the 1st, my boss called me in and said, Thacker, I want you to go up to Seattle and pick up a four-engine B-17 Flying Fortress. And I said, Captain, I've never even sat in the left seat of a B-17. And he said, Thacker, don't you understand orders in English? Go up and pick up a B-17 and fly it back to your base here. And here is your navigator. And I said to the navigator, what are you doing in a flying cadet uniform? And they said, they jerked me right out of navigation school, and I'm your navigator. So we went up to Seattle, we picked up a B-17, and we flew back to Salt Lake City. And this was the 4th of December, and we took off from Salt Lake, six of us, to shake the airplanes down and to get accustomed to our navigators. And this, we were a ferry crew, really. We had no guns. We were actually on secret orders, but we wanted to find out what the cruise control was because the B-17E was a little changed from the other B-17s. So we took off Friday night, and we got snowed out of Salt Lake, and we landed at Tucson. Saturday morning, we got a call from General Marshall, the number one Army man. He said, get out of bed. We were downtown hotel out of Tucson. We landed at the commercial airport because there wasn't any Tucson in those days. Nevertheless, he said, get out of bed, get your airplane ready to go, and go to Hamilton Field, which is 20 miles north of San Francisco, and stop by Sacramento and pick up anything you want, but we'll see you in Hamilton Fields. So I picked up. We never went back home. We left cars, women, laundry. So I called Betty Jo in Salt Lake, and I said, honey, if you want to see me, I think you better drive over to Hamilton. So she and a friend drive over Donner Pass in snow, you know how high. And when she got to Hamilton, they wouldn't let her on the field. And she started to cry and wanted to see this officer of the day, and they finally let her on. So Saturday night, December 6th, we had dinner at the officer's mess, and the gentleman sitting right next to us at the table was General Arnold, our number one Air Force man. What was he doing at Hamilton Field? He was making damn sure that these airplanes took off that night for Honolulu. So I said, honey, if you want to know who's who around here, I'll be flashing my landing lights as I taxi out. Took off about 10 o'clock Saturday night, beautiful evening. Second navigational ride with my navigator in a flying cadet uniform, in a flying cadet, $75 a month. took off at 10, nice and smooth. We were about 10,000 all the way. And about an hour out, I started playing with some nav stuff we had. The radio station stayed on all night at Honolulu for us.
Now, I don't want to interrupt your story because you're on a roll, but I'm just wondering, I'm putting two and two together here. You're about 23 years old. You've got a wife you just said goodbye to. You're flying a plane that you didn't have much time in with a crew that really had no experience, and you're in the night over nothing but ocean all night. Were you at all intimidated by any of that?
Well, we had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three star fixes all night long. Hobdi, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian, and I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower, no answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, blah, blah, blah. No one said, come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, the tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, bang, 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 bang all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days, you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I chopped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me. They shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial air drop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line. And if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
Whew. I can't imagine the amount of things that go through your mind in a situation like that when you know that your friends are dying, you don't know what's going to happen to you. How did you respond to the chaos?
Everything went out of those barracks. Everything went out of those hangars. There were motorcycles. There were people. There were engines. Everything was on fire. They wiped out that. They did a beautiful job with it. And 13 biddies, I think they were, at about 8,000. And they didn't miss. They really wiped out that flight line. And where are you going to go? What are you going to do? How can you help? How can you protect? First thing you do is protect your crew, which we left that out. And a little sort of side story. I took the crew down to the Royal Hawaiian Hotel on Wednesday for lunch. It was all free. The Japs were going to take the islands. There's no question about it. We had no foxholes. We had no nothing. It's an unbelievable story. And the Japanese did such a perfect operation. Mass, surprise, all of the great elements of war, and they did it beautifully. There's no question about that. They sank every boat in that harbor. There were 3 feet of bunker fuel on fire in Pearl Harbor. They sank every boat in the harbor. They sank the floating dock, and they sank the boat in the floating dock. Quite an operation.
And I know as someone with the military background that you have, you can appreciate the success of their operation, but I'm sure emotionally for you, being an American, wearing that uniform, and seeing that devastation had to have some kind of impact on you. What did it do to you in terms of your focus and desire to do anything?
You asked me where I grew up, and I said I grew up in the Air Force. That grew you up real quick. Real quick. But I think my attitude is just a little bit different because the military was going to be my career. I made a judgment at that time. And the military is like any other, it's like General Motors or any other big corporation. And it was my job. It was my job. And I was lucky to survive. I owe this lovely home to surviving 31 years in the Air Force. So my attitude is a little bit different than the great guys I was with, really, because most of them were draftees, actually, and I was a volunteer in 1937. So the situation is a little bit different.
Robert Thacker was a little bit different. One of those people that made a lasting impression wherever he went. It's break time, but we'll hear more of his World War II memories when we come back, including one time he became eternally grateful that the bombs his plane dropped over a ship that had been shooting at him did not hit their target. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.